Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, June 29th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. I'm going to start the show today with a little data.
Okay.
This is according to Gallup, the pollster Gallup. So in 1996, Cherry, 27% of American adults were in favor of legalizing same-sex marriage, 27% in 96.
Mm-hmm.
By 2022, that's not that long.
Yeah.
71% were in favor.
Wow, huge swing.
One of the fastest public opinion shifts on any civil rights issue we've ever seen. However, that was 2022, 71%. Since then, it's ticked down to about 65%.
Mm.
So for the first time in a long time, we have a small but sustained downtick in the percentage of American adults who are in favor of the legalization of same-sex marriage.
Mm.
Today on the show, we're going to explore that. It's not the only data point where we've seen this trend.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are going to ask, what are the potential causes behind that? What are some of the other data saying? And of course, we're going to ask what you think. Have you noticed a decline in public support for LGBTQ plus rights? Do you sense something changing? And if so, what do you think is behind the shift? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, you can always comment in the live chat.
Yeah, and it is Pride Month, and this June marks 11 years since same-sex marriage was deemed a constitutional right.
Yep.
And so we'd love to get your thoughts on this. Again, have you noticed a decline in public support for LGBTQ plus rights? And if so, what do you think is behind the shifts? We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. We have our trio.
Got to start with the trio.
By the way, I had to recognize Avi Wolfman-Arendt is back. He was gone for a week on vacation. He came back all tanned up and relaxed in the face. Love it.
I was relaxed when I came back at 9 o'clock this morning. I'm not relaxed anymore, but I am still tanned.
We threw a lot at you.
I am still tanned though. I still got that.
Yes. Trio of local news story. Glad to have you back, Avi.
Thank you, Cherry.
Philadelphia-based Comcast is planning to split into two publicly traded companies as competition in streaming and entertainment gets a whole lot stiffer.
Mm.
Comcast will continue as Comcast and basically focus on broadband connectivity and wireless, and then it'll spin off NBC Universal, and they will focus on media and entertainment, and NBC Universal will also include the European media company Sky. That announcement came today. Comcast leadership explained that separating the companies allowed them to pursue strategic priorities, invest in growth, and better compete in the market, because a lot of things are changing like every day.
A lot of competition.
And this is yet another spinoff move by Comcast. And if you recall, Avi, back in November of 2024, they announced that cable channels MSNBC, CNBC, Oxygen, E!, Golf Channel USA, and Sci-Fi would be put into a separate company. They also spinned off Fandango and Rotten Tomatoes. So there's been a lot of separation going with these massive businesses. Because you remember, Comcast had a lot going on under one
big bundle
entity.
Yes.
And, you know, it's not totally unexpected because Comcast shares were down about 30% over the past year. And they say that this move will allow them to focus on dealing with their cable subscriber losses. They've been bleeding, you know, subscribers.
Yep.
And so now they want to boost their Xfinity wireless business as well. And so you've seen the whole market shift, because originally the big thought, Avi, was, you know, these big behemoth companies would be better able to compete. But they're finding out the streamers are kicking their behinds.
Yeah. And there's lots of competition even in the core business, right? Because the thing that helped make Comcast a behemoth was the connectivity, right?
Yep.
So your cable television, but also your internet connectivity. But now you've got wireless providers in the internet game as well. T-Mobile is offering internet.
Yeah.
And by the way, you can tell, because you go to Comcast or you go to Verizon or whatever, and they're like, we'll lock you in for 5 years at a low rate. Like they're competing for market share right now because they've got new competition. You've got Starlink out there as well. So on both sides of the business, there is heat. It's also just fascinating to watch this reversal play out, and neither of us are like, you know, business experts, but you know, the big merging that happened not that long ago, where they bundled all these things in together, and The idea was at scale, we can do so much stuff. And now you're seeing it all kind of break apart. Mm-hmm. And that's just fascinating to watch that reversal happen really in a pretty short period of time. We're talking less than 20 years here.
Yeah. I want to point out that the leadership, Brian Roberts, the chairman, will still be over. Comcast and NBC Universal will have two separate CEOs, but Brian Roberts will be still the big guy kind of in co-leadership with them. So they'll still be working in tandem, I'm assuming. Yeah. But like you said, you have to break up in order to kind of be nimble enough to compete today.
Yeah. No word on which company Jack Donaghy will join.
Yeah.
Story number two. Mm-hmm. Earlier today, just a couple hours ago, the Joe Frazier statue was officially unveiled at the base of the Art Museum steps. This is the spot formerly inhabited by the Rocky statue, which is now inside the museum for the moment. The Frazier statue used to be down at the South Philly Sports Complex for years. Mm-hmm. Folks lobbied to get it in a more prominent place. You guys know Joe Frazier, longtime Philly resident, one of the great heavyweight boxers of all time. He inspired parts of the Rocky character, and there was always grumbling, and in some ways there still is, that people here and elsewhere maybe over-recognize Rocky and underappreciate the greatness of Joe Frazier. So moving his statue to the Art Museum is part of a broader attempt to balance that narrative. If you're wondering about the Rocky statue, it's sort of complicated right now.
Mm-hmm.
The Rocky statue, I guess the quote-unquote real one, is inside the Art Museum at the moment. There is a replica at the top of the steps that belongs to Sylvester Stallone on loan. Later this summer, the quote-unquote real one will move from inside the museum to the top of the steps, and the one that's at the top of the steps now will go to Sly Stallone, and I don't know what he wants to do with it, but anyways, we're doing sort of the three-card Monty and the shuffle with with the statues right now. That's still happening, but the big news today, Joe Frazier statue right there in a very prominent place at the bottom of the Art Museum steps.
Yeah, a lot of people saying about time.
It's
about time. By the way, shout out to the city for making this move in time for the 250th anniversary, because so many people are in the city. So they get to see Joe Frazier at the bottom of those stairs and take that iconic photo. By the way, I listened to the mayor's remarks today, and she said she told Sylvester Stallone that she appreciated what the Rocky statue had done to highlight the story of the underdog and grit, but that it was time to put Joe Frazier at the Art Museum. And he told her that's exactly what's supposed to happen. So he was actually very much on board and supportive of that. And she touted that in her remarks today. So I was like, this is great. We're all happy. Nobody's mad.
And part of this equation, too, is that the PMA, the Art Museum, has now sort of embraced the Rocky statue. For a while, there was sort of not an icy relationship, but they kind of wanted to keep it at a remove. And one of the things that convinced the PMA to more tightly embrace the Rocky statue was a podcast produced here at WHYY called
Shout
The
out.
Statue.
Yeah. Shout out to the statue.
And they apparently, it's reported in the New York Times, they heard that, the leadership heard that podcast, and sort of did change their minds a little bit.
Yeah. So there you go. We can go see Joe Frazier now at the
great Smokin' Joe Frazier.
Yeah.
Smokin' Joe.
Third story today. With the nation's 250th days away, there's been a bit of a rivalry between Philly and our New England neighbor, Boston. Yes, over who owns Revolutionary History, okay? Apparently, Boston has argued that they got us beat, with one historian saying that Boston did the work of the revolution, but Philly just did the paperwork. Ouch, okay? Ouch, shots fired.
First of all, it was the parchment work, not the paperwork back then, Boston. Get it right.
Get it right, okay? Very cool write-up by Dugan Arnett of the Philadelphia Inquirer, who takes us through his own historical trip in Beantown. Apparently, Boston has a lot going for it. I went to college there. I can attest to that. They have the Boston Tea Party. It's the place where Ben Franklin was born. It's the place where, you know, nearby where the Pilgrims arrived. But Arnett argues that Boston has been playing fast and loose with the historical facts. And I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
The story of Paul Revere's midnight ride from Boston to Lexington in April of 1775 to alert the militia that the British were coming. Well, apparently, Paul Revere never made it down there. He didn't do it. It was three people riding, and Paul Revere was the only one who didn't make it. That's
what?
One of many facts, okay?
That's shocking.
That's not necessarily been
more
told
like small
truthfully.
Revere.
Oh, yeah. And then the other one that Arnett points out is that he went to Plymouth, Massachusetts to see the Plymouth Rock. And apparently he calls it the Plymouth Croc because the rock itself isn't that big.
More like the Plymouth Stone.
It's more like I could probably pick it up both hands. So there you go.
Okay.
So anyway, we.
What do you want from me now?
I just want to. What do you think? You're the history lover here. Your thoughts on this, Avi Wolf and Eric?
Here's my thought. This is the 250th.
Yeah.
This is about unity. It's not about fighting.
Oh, look at you.
And Philly and Boston, although we hate each other, we're kind of like brothers in a way. And what we really need to do is turn on the real enemy.
Yeah.
Which is New York.
Okay.
Because New York was a hotbed of loyalist sentiment during the Revolution, and it folded immediately like a cheap card table.
Oh.
The British came right on in there and took it over, and the people celebrated in the streets when the British came into New York.
They did.
Philly and Boston, we both played an important role. Let's join together and turn on New York.
That's right. I love it. And Bam. We'll be right back. We're talking about the LGBTQ community. This is Studio 2. Don't go anywhere. And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Aaron. All month we've had parades and celebrations across the country in support of Pride Month, but the festivities are coming at an interesting time. Mm-hmm. After decades of growing public support for LGBTQ plus issues, research and polling show a recent reversal.
Yes, according to a recent Gallup poll, support for same-sex marriage has fallen by 6% in the last few years, with the sharpest downturn among Republicans and independents. And our research shows an increase in anti-gay bias amongst Americans.
So today we're asking you, have you noticed a decline in public support for LGBTQ plus rights? Have you sensed something shifting? And if so, what do you think is behind that shift? Give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, comment in the live chat.
Yeah, we're going to lay the foundation by starting today with someone who has been in the weeds trying to make sense of all this. We have Tessa Charlesworth, an assistant professor at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management and a research psychologist who studies bias and political partisanship. Tessa, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, Tessa, it's really nice to have you on the program. We laid out some statistics earlier in the show, but I'm curious what you're seeing in your research. Have you detected a shift in the way the American public views LGBTQ plus rights, LGBTQ plus people, and how big is the change that you've detected, if any?
Yes. So just like Gallup, when we've looked more broadly at attitudes towards the group of people. So Gallup typically studies attitudes about policy, right? So they're looking at same-sex marriage support. What we've done is actually broadened that to ask, how do people feel about gay and lesbian people themselves? And we also have broadened it to look not just at what people say, which are their explicit biases, but also what people feel more unconsciously or in a less controlled way through their implicit biases. But even with those different methods and even with those different, you know, approaches to bias, we also find backlash in anti-gay prejudice. So on implicit measures, so implicit bias, which are these more reaction time, like speeded computer tasks that you take, there we've seen an increase of 22% in anti-gay bias since 2020. Wow. And explicit bias, so what people are actually saying, now this was pretty small to start with. The bias was pretty small to start with because we've made so much progress over the past about 14 years. But it's also, you know, you can imagine a hockey stick. It's also risen, actually tripling in bias from where it was in 2020.
Yeah. You know, Tessa, have you all sort of found any rationale behind this? And if so, tell us what you found.
Yeah, so one cue to us actually came from two other pieces of data. So the first was that it actually isn't just sexuality bias that's going up. We tested anti-Black bias, anti-elderly bias, anti-fat bias, anti-disability bias. All of them were going up since 2020. And that's one piece of data. The second piece is that when we looked at who was jumping the fastest in bias, it was young people. And that was actually really shocking to us and pretty disheartening, because we often think of young people as like our vanguards of social progress. But the fact that we were seeing young people increase in bias more quickly than even older people or middle-aged people told us a big cue, which we pointed to something that would affect all kinds of biases but be targeted towards young people. And we pointed to that being the kind of threat and online hate that happened right around COVID, actually. So COVID 2020, which is right when we see the inflection point of increasing bias in our data, did this thing of creating threat and hostility in our communities. And we all know that threat creates scapegoating and blame, and we want to point fingers. And that was happening across a whole bunch of different groups. Then add to that the fact that we all went online, and especially young people went online for their schooling, for their communities, and on those online spaces was an amplifying toxicity and hostility. And so we think, it was this perfect storm, especially for young people, that started happening around 2020 of all of these different co-occurring threats that really had the spark with COVID.
And so, are there causes that you would rule out or that you would say are less likely based on the fact that you found these various biases increasing in tandem?
Yes. So we were really interested in very specific hypotheses that have often been given in the sort of attitude space. One of them being that anti-gay bias will increase because of a kind of spillover from anti-trans bias. So we had been seeing, rises in anti-trans legislation, in hate crimes. And so we thought, oh, maybe people are picking up on that, and that is causing the change, the increase in anti-gay bias. We didn't find any evidence of that. So there was no sort of lagged effect or spillover effect specifically from anti-trans bias. Actually, both were just going up almost in lockstep. We also looked at other kind of simple explanations, like maybe this is just about, the rhetoric or the sayings of a certain leader. We didn't find anything like that. We didn't find that it was just a rhetoric around, sexual grooming or these kinds of moral panic ideas. It really seemed to be this widespread ecosystem that started with COVID and this kind of existential threat that a lot of people were experiencing, and then were turning towards hostility.
So I am also curious, just as someone who works with data and statistics, like this time period that we're talking about is, so you said around 2020 is when sort of the inflection point is. Like, how significant is that period of time that's elapsed since 2020 in like a sort of a broader methodological sense? Like, is that a long period of time? Is it still a short enough period of time where we might, colloquially describe it as a blip? Because I don't know, the old saying is sort of it takes three to make a trend, but I don't know in terms of longitudinally how many years it takes to really establish that this is something that's changing and that it's worth like digging a little deeper on.
Yeah, it's a great question. So our models, we've done kind of, you can imagine like weather forecasting models to see what trend might happen in the future. And they suggest that these 5 years, they've definitely slowed our progress, but we had so much change in the past from 2000 really onwards that they're still kind of, we have a hockey stick, but it still potentially could curve back. At the same time, I will tell you, we had previous data around 2016 where we also saw a really quick increase in bias, and we were able to point towards certain kinds of rhetoric and certain kind of leaders. But those came down within a year. So we had these kind of temporary bumps in the past. It's the first time that we've seen in our data, and even in the Gallup poll, it's the first time that we've seen a reversal that's lasted more than just 2 years. So, as much as there's a possibility that we can still turn the ship around, I do think once we pass actually the 3 year mark, the 4 year mark, now the 5 year mark, we've added the 2025 data. I think we're getting into a point where this is really showing us like a new weather pattern, if you will.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's Tessa Charlesworth, an assistant professor at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. She's also a research psychologist who studies bias and political partisanship. Tessa, thank you so much.
Thanks for your questions.
And our next guests are standing by, but first, a reminder, our question for you today, have you noticed or sensed a decline in public support for LGBTQ plus rights? If so, what do you think is behind that shift? We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat.
And joining us now are two members of the LGBTQ plus community. We're going to share how each of them views this landscape change.
Our first guest right across the table from me is Angela Giampolo, founder of Giampolo Law Group, nationally known as Your Gay Lawyer. She's also an LGBTQ plus legal advocate serving the Philadelphia community. Angela, thanks for being here.
Thank you
on
for
Studio
having me.
Too.
Absolutely.
Let me also welcome Albert Eisenberg, principal at Redbridge, a Philadelphia-based political consulting firm and advisor to the American Unity Fund. Albert, thanks for being here on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
So Albert and Angela, you know, for 25 years, we saw support for LGBTQ rights going up, up, up. And then over the past few, we've seen it trending downward. First, I'd like for you both to give your reaction to what you heard Tessa say, but then your own hypothesis on why we've had this downward trend. And Angela, we'll start with you.
Yeah, that wasn't what I expected. Mm-hmm. As far as the data and her explanation of COVID really being sort of a crux of it. But like you were saying, Avi, things can have, you know, multiple factors sure. at play. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that she mentioned was the threat, an existential threat that COVID created, mm-hmm. you know, universally. And so there's also a psychological phenomenon and a political phenomenon called elite queuing, where leaders and so the poll was, you know, 1,000 people that they called up and talked, you know, to. And of those, the Republicans, so, you know, your average Republican person will take their cue from their leaders on issues predominantly that they are unfamiliar with mm-hmm. or potentially afraid, like the most sort of influence happens with issues where folks are unfamiliar with or afraid mm-hmm. of, right?
And so this influences the opinions of the broader group.
So you have your everyday Republican looking at their leader who post, you know, the 24 election, the rhetoric has been, right, next level. And so then you have the Republican leaders taking their cue from the Trump administration. And so, you know, I personally, my hypothesis, if you mm-hmm. will, is that their elite queuing of folks, you know, looking up to their leaders.
So your hypothesis, your argument is that because the leadership of the party has sort of been anti-trans in a lot of instances, especially when it comes to women's sports, you know, trans individuals
taking
in the
away
military,
their passports,
all those things, that is the Republicans broader are following that. Albert, I'd love to get your take, your reaction to Tessa, but also your hypothesis on why you think there has been this downward trend in support.
Yeah, it's a really important conversation. I appreciate you having me. I've been out gay since I was 18. I've been a registered Republican since I was 18. That was unfortunately longer ago than I feel comfortable with. But I've seen some of the trends come and go. There's definitely a shifting landscape that the Gallup poll is covering, that my team is very engaged with, and that a number of polls, the Northwest University data, that Tessa referenced, and just overall trend lines where we have seen increases in support throughout the 90s, the 2000s, the aughts, and the 2010s for all sorts of what you call LGBT policy and sort of general social acceptance. And now we're seeing a pretty shift downturn, certainly on the Republican side, also among independents. I think that there's some truth to what the researcher Tessa said, as far as us living in a very intense moment as a society where there's a lot of division and a lot of consumption of negative media online, where you sort of create the worst avatar of your political opponent and make them maybe cherry pick the strongest and most outrageous examples of behavior and associate it with everybody. So this happens on the right and the left. It's a problem. I think the LGBT movement and establishment overall has gotten out over its skis, unfortunately, in a lot of ways. I think I'll probably have hopefully a polite disagreement with Angela on that. But I think we went from a movement that was asking for marriage and basic rights, employment rights, protections and housing, to one that then got all of that under the banner of, hey, we're just like you. We just want to love who we want to love and live and work with dignity, to a movement that was chasing down cake bakers and wedding photographers who wouldn't do custom work, who ended up advocating for the medicalization of under 18-year-olds who have gender dysphoria, who deserve good therapy, but probably not medical transition, And then who basically denied the existence of biological reality. And men and women, biologically, XX chromosomes and XY chromosomes are different overall. And I think that people on the LGBT, people who are concerned about this as I am, we can't overstate how damaging the image of Leah Thomas coming out of University of Pennsylvania was for the national LGBT movement.
And I want to give you a chance to respond to that, Angela.
Of course.
Absolutely. So you can disagree without discriminating, right? So there's disagreement. And if I disagree with someone, I will defend the right for that person to have that opinion. But to disagree, to discriminate, to dehumanize, and to basically erase and try to eradicate a group of people in this country, that is where we are right now with trans folks, is we have criminalized their very existence. In September of 2025, Charlie Kirk was assassinated by a cis man, but he had a trans girlfriend. That's where that crux was. And then September 25th, 10 days later, you had NS, National Security Presidential Memo 7, that was put out stating that trans ideology is domestic terrorism and we need to address it. Then you had the Bondi memos in December stating that, you know, we're going to enforce the FBI with bounties and tip lines and we need to find these trans people. And there was bounties. There was money associated with finding trans advocates. And then in April of this year, there was a line item put to that budget. $166 million to enforce SMNSPM7, which ultimately says that trans folks or anyone like myself, I am a trans ideologist because I serve the LGBTQ plus community, are domestic terrorists. What stemmed from that as far as all of the hospitals? We've seen CHOP successfully defend the subpoena around getting client patient data. They served their first criminal subpoena to these hospitals. We don't know how, just a couple days ago, June 24th, the judge came down and put the kibosh on that and said an egregious opinion that ultimately you are trying to dehumanize and eradicate a group of people. A judge's opinion said that.
So I guess what I'm trying to just to summarize, you're saying that the work of the activist community to push back against those things is necessary and regardless of what the consequences of that are in public opinion, or you're saying it's not responsible for the shift in public opinion, just to clarify.
It's part of the shift in public opinion. I mean, in my opinion, the rhetoric that is coming down from the administration from on day one, January 20th, declaring there are only two sexes in this country, male and female, taking away passports. We can disagree. Why do all of that?
Yeah. And Albert, I want to get your response to Angela before we have a couple callers we want to bring in. But I'd love to get your response to Angela's take about the elite queuing. Specifically, you know, and she just mentioned, you know, when the Trump administration came into office on day one, there were specific, you know, executive orders that took action and limited freedoms and rights of LGBTQ folks. And so your thought on just that queuing to the, you know, to Republicans, to just the broader American community, and sort of having this impact on sentiments and support of LGBTQ rights?
I think the sentiment tends to shift as a result of people's perceptions of other groups, and then the tail sort of wags the dog. Like, I work in public messaging, so my general perspective is the public moves somewhere thanks to media consumption, social media, current events, and then most sort of politicos and administrations and elected officials and bureaucracies sort of follow that. That's my general perspective on why things change. And I think when you see what the polling bears out, which is a steady increase in support for LGBTQ plus until 2022 or 2023, and you see a sharp drop, which is what the Gallup polling showed, that's pre-second Trump admin, that's during the Biden administration. I think that there's, and I just, overall, I mean, I'm just myself, so I'm not here to throw a rainbow flag on anybody or anything, but we do have the highest ranking out gay official to ever have served the country in Scott Bessent, who's our Treasury Secretary. We haven't seen, massive rollbacks. And we have the Respect for Marriage Act, which passed with a bipartisan majority, thankfully. And I don't see the same viewpoint of, massive attacks on LGBT people coming from the right, but I do sense a rising backlash against LGBT overall. So I think both of those things are true.
Let me read in some comments. This is Miguel on YouTube, who says they're seeing a decline at the international level. The recent Colombian election gave the win to a Trump-backed right-wing candidate, and anti-LGBTQ messaging was a core message of his campaign. I want to bring in a caller who wants to remain nameless, but I think is calling in from Montgomery County. Caller, I can't address you by your name, but you are on Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
Yes, my comment is that there's a growing contingent of LGB community and Democrats that are pushing back against the forced teaming with the TG. The denial of biological material reality has severe implications for society and the LGB community, which is based on biological same-sex attraction. And TQ people are just as deserving of protection of their rights in employment and discrimination, which Bostock has secured. But the extreme overreach, and I'm so glad to hear Albert speaking about it, needs to stop.
So what do you see as the main areas of overreach, if I could just keep you for a moment longer? Like, what is an example of the overreach as you see it?
Well, the central issue is the delusionary denial of biological reality, but everyone's entitled to their delusion. But to force it into society, into schools, into girls' sports, into and stripping away women's rights to private spaces that threatens our safety and our dignity, that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me read this comment from John on Facebook.
Yeah, I was looking at that.
Mm-hmm. Who says, I would get on work meetings and the host would demand I list my pronouns. You have the right to be whatever you want, but I have the right to not accept nonsense. So this is a talking issue. Point you see, Angela, that people will say the tipping point for them is when it went from securing rights to imposing some sort of ideology. I am curious how you respond to that. Do you think that imposition is not happening? Do you think it's overstated? Do you think it is actually a broader shift we need to make in our consciousness about how we see the binary of gender? Your thoughts.
Yeah. I always go back to facts, not fear, right? If folks just stayed in facts and not fear, she mentioned, pushing girls in schools. And I mean, out of 8 million high school athletes, if between 1 in 2% of people in this country are trans, out of 8 million high school athletes, that is 38,000 are trans. I mean, there is no taking over of sports. The facts, to use your words, it is completely overstated, right? NCAA, 510,000 NCAA athletes. When the president of the NCAA testified in front of Congress, he could only identify 10 trans folks.
Yeah.
But and then when talk about in schools, don't say gay. The law don't say gay came about in Florida when there wasn't even a curriculum pushing.
And let me ask you this as a follow-up, Angela, because I get what you're saying. Like this issue with, trans athletes playing in women's sports. A lot of people have said it's very few trans women trying to play in women's sports. Give you that. But a lot of, and I think a big pushback, even from some liberal people that I've talked to, has been that, you know what? I didn't want to be told the pronouns. I didn't want to go into the bathroom and see a man in the bathroom. And they felt like some of the advocacy pushed too far in their and into their world, right? And so the backlash was beating up on the one trans woman trying to get into play on a team or something like that. Do you see a correlation between that push into people's world, the pronouns and all of the bathroom changes and all of that, as being part of the backlash or reason for the backlash?
What is the big concern with pronouns? Why, at the end of the day, if you're asking someone to not be visible, why don't you want to see them? Who cares? At the end of the day, visibility is, in fact, I have rainbow heels on, and that visibility is not for the people annoyed by me. It's for the people who need to see me. Mm-hmm. That's what visibility is about. That's why we fly a flag. I'm a Steelers fan. If I see an Eagles shirt as I walk by, I don't yell at them.
Brave of you to admit that.
Exactly. That is my whole point. Yeah. There are a lot of things that we don't agree with. You can disagree without discriminating. You can disagree without eradicating. I worked in human trafficking before I did LGBTQ law. I worked in genocide. I've seen genocide at the Rwandan genocide level.
And Angela, I just want to read this because Matt says, I'm all for LGBTQ plus rights. I was in Provincetown when marriage was legalized and it was a great celebration by all. That said, I think that politically the LGBTQ plus community has overplayed its hand. As you noted, the change happened fast. Most cultural changes occur much more slowly. I don't think that most people really care who someone sleeps with. And if someone doesn't mention it, you can't tell, yet it is very frequently mentioned by the media. I think this overexposure hurts the cause.
Two things. One thing about the elite queuing, because you mentioned we're at like 22 and then went to 71 and in such a short amount of time. President Obama had a lot to do with that when he evolved.
Yeah.
When he evolved, 85% of black folks changed their view on marriage equality. Because they looked when a president states their view on a civil rights issue, the people follow. And so, yes, there was a drastic shift during that time period. And now we're seeing a backlash. We're going back and people are much more open with being able to and feel comfortable stating what they disagree with.
Let me ask you about that, Albert. Do you think that this is really ultimately just about polarization and partisanship, so that the heads of the Republican Party, as Angela laid out, have pursued a political strategy that has to do with restricting trans rights. People kind of just fall in line, and we are just in an era where you kind of just have to be in lockstep with what your camp says on any issue, and that it's a little bit less about the specific policy goals of the LGBTQ plus movement. And again, just a, you know, sort of Occam's razor explanation here, by, you know, partisanship, polarization is a growing force in our country.
Yeah. I mean, I like the Occam's razor perspective. I think the simplest explanations are the clearest, which is, one, the movement and its messengers stopped advocating for what feels like sort of normal, everyday, neighborly things and started bullying people who dissented from LGBT, you know, the line. Biological gender is not real. This is, you know, something that was invented. I think most, you're out of the norm of what regular normal voters think, including a lot of Democrats. The medicalization of children, I cannot overemphasize enough. I mean, I think in a couple years, people will have memory hold that. But my perspective is a 16 or 17 year old cannot consent to a double mastectomy. The Children's Hospital of Philadelphia was treating youth in that way. I think that's a human rights issue.
But I
think that's an overreach.
Go ahead.
And I also think that, you know, people shift and we're in a very politically divisive time. And the LGBT movement, I'm a Republican, I'm out gay in every room I go into, but it is associated with the left. And yeah, we're in a very, very partisan time right now. And I think vulnerable minority groups need to be very aware of this perspective and be tactical in how we speak and operate.
Well, let me ask you about that association, right? Because you're saying it sort of could be both things, right? It could be increasing partisanship and the messaging of the community. And then I guess I would point to, there are countries like the commenter brought up, I think it was Colombia, but there's Zimbabwe, Russia, Turkey, places where the LGBTQ movement is not pushing for anything to do with transgender rights, but probably just sort of basic equality. And in those cases, the kind of, you might call nationalists, I might say illiberal forces, have still been able to seize on that and use sort of anti-gay gay rhetoric to firm up their base, to grow their power. Like, who's to say that the right could not have done this regardless of what was done around trans issues in this country, if I'm making sense? You know what I mean? The idea that you didn't need the first part in order to have the political sort of gunpowder for the backlash.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of complicated. Like, the leader of the right-wing party in Germany is a lesbian. Iran said they don't have homosexuals in 2009, I think, when it was Ahmadinejad. We're LGBT overall, gay and transgender, is always going to be a very small minority of people, and we rely on a lowercase l liberal societal order in order to have basic rights and respect and safety. And I think that we're seeing a lot of changes in our country and how people treat each other and media consumption in norms. And it's putting at risk a lot of people globally. I will just add one more thing. A lot of countries, from France to the Arab and Muslim world, have viewed LGBT culture, lifestyle, whatever you want to call it, as an American export, and have moved away from it, yeah, in demonizing sort of the West and American culture.
And let me try to squeeze another caller in. We have Howard from Philly on the line. Howard, you're on Studio 2. We only have a few more minutes left in the program, but if you could briefly give us your question or comment.
Yeah, real quick. I think hypocrisy is the fuel for a lot of the beliefs of this new administration. I agree with the call, with your guests and so forth. That administration has a lot to do with it. The stance they take, as in the Barack case, the stance that Trump guys takes, their followers tend to follow their nonsense. And it's hypocrisy, because at the same time, you know, they take pictures with child molesters and so forth, but then they want to go ahead and give this judgment against, you know, the LGBT community. So I think hypocrisy fuels all that. Now, something else. One thing that I wish people would stop seeing. One quick thing, real quick, and then I'm going to let you, you know, listen and talk. People keep say forcing, you know, that forcing, but I don't understand where that's coming from. Give you a quick example. I'm sitting up here looking at my...
And Howard, I got to stop you because we only have a minute left. Howard, thank you so much for that call. As we wrap up, I just want you to each tell me where you think this movement is headed, because you have 6% now, but this has been trending for a couple of years. Angela, what do you think people, advocates in the LGBTQ community, need to do to sort of offset this, to make sure that next year we're not talking about 12% or 30%?
The big thing, and two of the three callers, you know, I'm not going to sell out the TQ community to buy my rights. We are the LGBTQ plus community. And it's like that poem, they came for the trade unionist, but I wasn't a trade unionist, so I didn't stand up. They came for the communist, but I wasn't a communist, so I didn't stand up. Came for the Jews, didn't stand up. They came for me, there was no one left to stand up. So a lot of the callers are saying there's an LGB and then there's the TQ. We need to stick together as a community. That's what Pride Month is for. We're going to get through this together. It's going to be generations. Where do I think the movement's going? I think it's generations before we truly see things coming back. But like Martin Luther King said, the arc of moral justice is long and bends towards equality. Yeah. So we're going to get there.
Yeah. And your thoughts as we wrap up, Albert, just where the movement needs to go to make sure that this sentiment doesn't continue to decline.
I think humility is a very underrated emotion in politics right now. It's basically non-existent. And if we want to bend the arc of sentiment towards basic protections for transgender, gay and lesbian family and adults, I think we need to acknowledge where our movement and our entities have overreached. The list is significant. I think we need to forge better ties with religious institutions and people who we agree with a lot of things on, but maybe not everything on.
Yep.
And I think we can probably just focus a little bit more on elevating sort of the needs of just normal gay and lesbian and transgender people, including in family formation that, policy.
Yep.
And
we'll we have to wrap it up there.
We'll leave it there. So thanks for having me on.
That's Albert Eisenberg, principal at Redbridge, Philadelphia-based political consulting firm. Thank you for your time. Angela Giampolo, founder of Giampolo Law Group, nationally known as Your Gay Lawyer. Angela, thank you for your time on Studio 2.
Yeah. And thank you to everybody who called in and wrote in today. Of course, Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Charlie Kyer engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolf-Manera, and we will talk to you tomorrow.